Hello, welcome listeners, and thank you for tuning into ThoughtWorks Insights from Tech Leaders podcast. Today, Rebecca Parsons and myself, Neil Ford, are going to be discussing evolutionary architecture. My name, as I said, is Neil Ford. I am a director, a software architect, and meme wrangler at ThoughtWorks because ThoughtWorks lets you pick your own titles. My website's neilford.com, and my Twitter handle is NEAL4D. It's the elite speak version of my name, Neil Ford. Joining me today is the ThoughtWorks CTO, Rebecca Parsons. I'll let her introduce herself.
Thank you, Neil. It's good to be here. And as Neil said, my name is Rebecca Parsons. I'm the Chief Technology Officer for ThoughtWorks. I do have a website, RebeccaParsons.com, and my Twitter handle is Rebecca Parsons, at Rebecca Parsons. I've been involved in various forms of agile architecture really since I joined ThoughtWorks back in December of 1999, when I was one of the few people who have as much gray hair as I do that got to celebrate December 31st, 1999, because I wasn't mission critical on anything yet.
And that brings us around to the topic of this morning, which is evolutionary architecture, which is something that Rebecca and I have both done a fair amount of thinking about and talking about over the years. I had a DeveloperWorks series for almost 2 years around evolutionary architecture and emergent design.
And that's an important distinction, the evolutionary versus emergent. When Neil and I first started talking about this, he was calling it emergent architecture, which I took some I had some questions about because.
Help me off the ledge.
And the reason for that is, you know, obviously architecture is something that's critical to a software system, and in fact, Martin often defines architecture as either the things that is the most difficult to change, or the things that an organization is most worried about, that's what the key part of architecture is. And the word emergent does inspire this almost ad hoc, we're not really thinking much about it, we're just sort of going along with the flow, and that really bothers people who take architecture quite seriously. And by calling it evolutionary architecture, what we're trying to focus on is, even if you don't have all the information to make the right decision initially, what you are looking at is guiding it towards an objective function, a goal architecture. And the upfront work that we think you need to be doing for architecture, rather than all of the complex designs and diagrams and tool selections on day one, what you do need to do on day one is think about, what are the critical success factors for your architecture? Doesn't need to be highly available, doesn't need to be highly scalable. Is security your major driving concern? Is it data loss? Those are all possible outcomes for architectures, and all systems don't display the same kind of characteristics. So that's what we mean when we're talking about evolutionary architecture.
And I think this distinction between evolutionary architecture and emergent design is a really useful one, although design has now gotten kind of muddled up in things like user experience design. But when I was talking about that, we was really talking about the things that are, in fact, easier to change later. There are elements within software stacks. For example, a struts is something that's relatively hard to change later if you choose that as a web framework. But the way you end up using it, you can change that around without disrupting the whole world. And so this idea, emergent kind of assumes that you can start with nothing and let it kind of grow naturally, whereas evolutionary suggests that you do, in fact, start with some structure, but you build into that structure the ability to change without making it crazy expensive or hard later.
Well, and I think that's an important thing to realize, because when you look at architecture, it is actually true that it would be most efficient if you got everything right the first time, if you guessed right at what the world would look like in 15 years and only had to build it perfectly once, that would be the most efficient. However, there's that pesky if at the beginning.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the world we live in is not one that you can say, this is how things are going to be. And I don't know about you, Neil, but my crystal ball is terrible.
Yeah, I keep trying these lottery numbers, and it keeps lying to me, so it's really tough.
Yeah.
Predicting the future is really tough. My friend Mark Richards, who I've done some software architecture videos with, I think says it really nicely when he says, all architecture becomes iterative, agile just does it sooner. Because one of the fundamental problems in architecture is you bump into the classic Donald Rumsfeld quote, the unknown unknowns, the things that you cannot anticipate up front because you've never built one of these exact things before, or, you know, the business changes in midstream and didn't bother to tell you that they were merging with another company or something like that, you're always going to encounter those things. So what we've been thinking lately, and in fact have started building more IP around this idea of evolutionary architecture, is what if you started designing architectures where change was one of the first considerations that you put into it, along with scalability and performance, and what would those kind of architectures look like?
And so part of what we're looking at putting together are, what are some principles that you need to support an evolutionary architecture? How can we design systems and architectures so that they are more resilient to the kinds of architectural changes that are also happening? What does it really take to make evolvability a first-class ability along with scalability and maintainability and all of those other things? And I think one of the things that we have to start with is, how do you decide when to make decisions, and when do you in fact make particular decisions? One of the things I always enjoyed from Neil's talks was this discussion of another form of technical debt, because we talk about technical debt in many different ways. You can think about it as, what would it take to actually get all of your systems up to the latest package level? And I've seen reports characterizing what the state of the industry is with respect to versions of Oracle or versions of PeopleSoft, et cetera. And then there's, of course, the technical debt that we talk about from a code perspective, where maybe we haven't paid as much attention to some of our quality metrics, or we've had to do a push at the end, or maybe our test coverage isn't quite as good. But if you think about the debt metaphor, another source of technical debt is when you have a stack, when you have a technology stack that is not right for what you're trying to do. There is a drag that is added to a development team when it's having to work in a more complex technical environment than is necessary. And so if we make early tool selections on this, well, maybe I'll need it later, what you were doing is you were adding this interest to every development activity that touches that piece of the technology. And so you can actually accumulate a great deal of debt through this process of simply making everything harder by making some of these decisions before you have the information available. And so we have this notion called the last responsible moment. I always preferred to call it the latest responsible moment, but last seems to have won in the court of public opinion, so I'll go along with it. But basically what that says is, you want to delay these critical decisions as long as possible. Now, you do that because the longer you delay, the more information you have available to make the right choice. The cost that you pay for delaying those decisions are, what are the decisions that you might have made differently if you had made that choice earlier on? Are there things that you might do differently? So very often I get asked, how do I pick the last responsible moment? And you go back to those things that are critical to you. If you have data security and data protection as a critical success factor, you're going to want to look at all of the decisions that will influence your ability to protect the data that you're working with. And those are the kinds of decisions that are most likely to have the broadest impact on all of the other design decisions and all of the other code decisions that you're making. And so you probably do want to make that earlier simply because the footprint is larger. So you use this evolutionary fitness function to guide your decision making.
Yeah, I really like this. Rebecca's the first one I heard talk about this idea of an evolutionary fitness function, of a way of thinking early on, because that's one of the things that agile architecture gets wrongly dinged for as a straw man is, oh, you don't do any planning, you just start coding stuff and the architecture comes together. That's not true. You try to adhere to, can I push off some of these decisions? Because you are trying to make really critical decisions at a time when you have very little data, and that's not a good time to make decisions. Last responsible moment lets you push out and hopefully gather some context and data to make some more realistic decisions about things. And that really becomes the critical success factors of your project, are the things that you make those fitness functions around.
Another thing that we've found around architectures, and of course, we're ThoughtWorks, so the word testing has to come in early and often, but we've noticed that if you think about the testability of your architecture, the testability that is implied for what you build from the perspective of your architecture, you end up with an architecture that is more resilient to change. And that shouldn't be that surprising, because one of the things, that you get from testability are those boundaries around things, those simple operations that this thing does one function and I have a very clear input and I have a very clear output. And when you start looking at that, it becomes much easier to change some of those components, whether it be change the implementation of one particular aspect of the system, whether it be to change out how it is that you exchange information or coordinate activities. But thinking about how you test not just your individual functions, but how you test the larger pieces of your system, how you check some of the messaging and the orchestration, or what we prefer, choreography of the system, how the different pieces fit together. Thinking about testability leaves you with a better architecture. So this is a win-win for us.
And this very nicely gets us out of the kind of plumbing where architecture has traditionally lived, and much more relevant for things like businesses today. And this is one of the reasons that Rebecca and I are spending more time thinking about this, because when you look at, for example, the microservice architecture, which is insanely popular right now, but it is a good example of an evolutionary architecture, and it enables something at a much higher level in the stack than just TDD, which is this idea of hypothesis-driven development. Once you have changeable components at a really good level of granularity that allows you to change things out, and you have things like the engineering practices of continuous delivery, allowing you to do things like A-B testing to put two components live at the same time and just let some of your users test this new component, this now allows the business to start posing hypotheses. What if we change the way that people interacted with this part of our website? Will we get better user interaction, better engagement, more safety? Being able to cast those hypotheses at a very high business level and then be able to achieve those hypotheses through the architecture, that's really this idea of evolutionary architecture, that you can, in fact, make small changes over time without disrupting the entire architecture. And this ends up giving a really powerful tool in the hands of the business to be able to change the way they think about doing research on websites.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because having been involved in the Agile movement for as long as ThoughtWorks has, we've watched the evolution. And it started out, well, that's all right for those developers to do, but as a business analyst, you know, I still need to do my entire mapping of all of this. And then we kind of brought the BAs on board. And, of course, you can't test a system until it's completely written. But we eventually brought the QAs on board. One of the major parts of the software development lifecycle, database administrators. And, well, of course, all of those other people can do this agile thing, but I need my data model locked down at the beginning because that's the only way to make it efficient. And there was a book written by Scott Ambler and Pramod Sadalog talking about how you refactor databases, how we apply the techniques that we use to change code to be able to actually more safely change production databases, even dealing with the problems of data migration. So this practice of refactoring databases is another one of these enabling practices for evolutionary architecture. Another key one is continuous delivery, as Neil mentioned. This is something that allows you to support the practice, the broader practice of evolutionary architecture, in a safe way. Much like Agile can be considered irresponsible if you don't do things like have your testing safety net and look at your system knowing you've got these interacting practices like continuous integration to support doing Agile software development, it is these same kind of practices that we're looking at in evolutionary architecture that allow you to do those same things safely, because you don't want to pull out a major part of your architecture and completely change it if you don't have the proper safety net, if you don't have the ability to reconfigure your environments reliably and reliably reproduce conditions that might have caused you problems, or to deploy on this regular basis and swap out and do hypothesis testing if you don't have the right kind of safety net. And so these practices are critical to making evolutionary architecture work.
Well, in fact, I think this has really fleshed out the topic of evolutionary architecture, because you can talk about it when you have very static operations, but you have very few dimensions of ability to evolve when you're in that situation. But when you introduce things like DevOps and continuous delivery, all of a sudden you've changed the level of granularity in which you can make changes in your architecture, and that becomes a really huge enabler for being able to make decisions at a higher level and be able to slice through your entire architecture and make those non-disruptive kind of evolutionary changes.
Well, and this, of course, then gets us to that pesky people and organizational problem. I'm not sure any conversation about evolutionary architecture can be had without mentioning Conway's Law.
That's right.
And
the drinking game.
Yes. And what you really have here is the extent to which things like the DevOps movement have altered the way organizations are thinking about structuring their teams, structuring their IT organizations. And of course, it's becoming more and more common that the barrier even between IT and the business is blurring as well, as more and more businesses actually are technology businesses that happen to do something specific like investment banking or retail. But this whole notion of DevOps is, again, moving some of these principles around how do we become more collaborative, how do we become more iterative, and allow ourselves to do some things more reliably by breaking down the barrier between the operations team and the development teams. And we're moving into an era where it's no longer an us versus them. It's a we that the development team understands the issues that the operations teams are encountering, and they can collaboratively discuss what's the best way for us to handle some of these things that are coming up in operations, that are coming up into production. And the operations folks can begin to also see the development, the people on the development team as on the same team and working towards the same objectives.
Yep, that becomes actually a superpower for organizations that have a mature DevOps organization. William Gibson, the famous science fiction author, has a great quote: "The future is already here; it's just not evenly distributed." And we still run into companies who have a very 20th century view of operations, that it's overhead, and you know, static is good, and no is the best answer for any question. But what they're going to find is that there are some businesses who are starting to leverage this ability to do hypothesis-driven development and evolutionary architecture as a business advantage. And you don't want to be in a place where the future is already here, it's just not evenly distributed, and you find yourself on the bad part of that curve because you haven't been paying attention to things like the DevOps revolution. You're going to find yourself all of a sudden at a serious business disadvantage, which is going to blindside a lot of companies, which, of course, is a bad thing. Well, we've reached the end of our time here. This brings our podcast to an end. Rebecca and I will continue talking about this subject quite a lot over the next few months or so. And we've got lots more material in this area. Thanks so much for listening to the ThoughtWorks Insights for Tech Leaders podcast. Feel free to share your feedback with us on iTunes or SoundCloud. Until the next time, take care and goodbye.